See you soon.
Thanks so much for that intro. I will put in a plug for the men's Bible study. Matt Weston is a regular there. Starting the Friday after Labor Day, we're going to be meeting here, this same room, every Friday morning at 7 a.m. Everyone's welcome to come. Come when you can. A lot of people come based on what they have to do with dropping off kids and picking up kids and everything else. There's only one requirement. You have to be a man. And I know probably half of you meet that requirement. So feel free to join us. Our topic tonight is marriage in a time of crisis. And I want to tell you a little story. On May 20th, 2018, I was sound asleep, and I was awakened by a ringing noise. Slowly, I realized it was our doorbell ringing at 2:30 in the morning. I glanced at the clock, and I realized it was 2:30. I wondered, what in the world's going on? I was still a bit groggy, and I stumbled to the door and looked out. Standing outside our door was a guy in khakis and a polo shirt. And I thought, what's the Amazon delivery guy doing? Now, today we had five Amazon deliveries. And my daughter's laughing because they're all for our grandkids. But anyway, I thought, you know, what's the Amazon delivery guy doing here at 2:30 in the morning? I was confused. I thought maybe he'd broken down, and then I realized, well, it's probably not the right time for an Amazon delivery. So I thought maybe somebody was going through the neighborhood and had broken down. And I was a little concerned about safety, so I looked out, looked around. He was by himself. So I opened the door a crack and said, what's up? He said, I'm from the Phoenix Police Department. And I watched enough British detective shows to know that you always ask for the ID, right? You gotta have them show the ID. So I said, show me your ID. So he did. And I ascertained that he really was a police officer. And I still wasn't sure what was going on. I thought maybe there was an incident in the neighborhood or something had happened. So I stepped outside and talked to him, and the first thing he said to me was, are you the father of Gary Summers? And I said, yes. And he said, I'm sorry to tell you that he's passed away yesterday. And I was just floored. I was shocked. This is not anything I'd expected. Gary had celebrated his birthday with us two weeks earlier. He turned 33, and we had a wonderful time with him. Earlier that week, I'd gone to the gym to work out with him. I was just shocked, floored. He'd had trouble with drugs, but he seemed to be sober and healthy. And I was just shocked by it all, totally shocked. The detective said it appeared to be a drug overdose, and we had a brief conversation about Gary's struggles over the years. But I told him that he seemed sober and clear-eyed and focused on the past 6 months. He handed me his card and Gary's driver's license, and then he left. I came back inside, and Gail, who had heard the noise and woken up too, came in, and she said, what's going on? And I said, Gary's dead. And she wailed and fell on the floor and sobbed. And we were just both in shock and disbelief. This is the kind of thing we don't expect when we make our wedding vows. On the first day, when we say for better or for worse, we don't envision a situation like this. It's not something we expect. Instead, we have excitement and joy on our wedding day. We have the support of the church and our friends. And we unite, and all those things unite to give us hope and confidence that our marriage will be wonderful and fruitful. Even if we come from dysfunctional families, and many of us do, we expect our experience to be different and filled with joy. That is a good and right thing, because we are overtaken by the power of the sacrament and its bond of unity. For in the sacrament of marriage, we are given the grace to become an icon, an image of the marriage between Christ, the true bridegroom, and his church, the true bride. We should experience that grace and the protection, armor, and strength that it brings. We understand on that day that as long as we have each other and continue to appropriate that grace, we have nothing to fear. But then as married life unfolds, stuff happens. We encounter challenges to that sacramental unity. Some are small and relatively easy to overcome. Others grow to be quite large and disruptive and affect the whole family, not just the husband and wife. These problems can disrupt family rhythms, plans, and relationships, and they may persist over time and be very difficult to resolve. They can come from either within or without the family, and they can cause confusion, frustration, turmoil, and different opinions about how to solve these problems. There are often challenges to our understanding, relationships, and expectations, and they can easily create discord in the family. They can also shake the foundation of our Catholic worldview. We're a Catholic family, and stuff like that doesn't happen to us, right? My kids shouldn't be on drugs. My kids shouldn't be on drugs. They challenge our confidence in the love and power of God as well, and his trustworthiness. How can you let this happen to us? Problems like this can eat away at the foundation of a family, the sacramental glue that holds us together. Now, the sacrament isn't magic. We need to work constantly and vigilantly at maintaining it, strengthening it, and letting God work in our lives. So our crisis is just one example of a crisis that can hit a family. Others can include job loss, severe financial difficulty, mental or physical health issues, the death of a family member, or severe marital discord. I'm sure you could add others as well, and I'm sure some of you may have experienced others as well. Our own crisis began when Gary started using drugs in high school, and it culminated with his death. That took us on a 14-year roller coaster ride. That took us on a 14-year roller coaster ride that ultimately culminated in his death. He died 2 weeks after his 33rd birthday, as I mentioned, and we were shocked because for the previous 6 months, he'd been sober, clear-headed, happy, and healthy. Many times in the past, we were expecting a visit from the detective. Gary was in and out of rehab, and we experienced many highs and lows. But this time, he seemed earnest in his sobriety. During his journey, we learned a great deal about dealing with addiction. But that's not really the focus of our talk tonight. The focus of our talk is going to be, how do you handle a crisis? What are the things that can help you manage a crisis as a married couple and stay married? So now I'm going to turn it over to Gail, and I forgot to turn on the recording. I'm sorry.
I'm recording.
Oh, you're recording.
We're recording. Yes, I'm good for something.
Oops.
He was so... Do you want to take this?
Sure.
Let me know if you can't hear me in the back, okay? All right. To answer the question about the stress that our family crisis put on our marriage, one word comes to mind: enormous. I doubt that we were unusual in this. Ours was a reasonably healthy marriage, not perfect, but healthy. We were committed to putting God first in our marriage and in our family life. We prayed with and for each other. We had our children baptized, and they all chose to be confirmed. We kept our vows to raise them to know and love and serve God as their greatest happiness. And still, we felt completely unprepared when the whirlwind struck. Neither of us had ever used drugs. We didn't know anything about drug addiction at all. And we floundered badly. What was the aftermath? Well, conveniently, the aftermath can be described in words all starting with the letter S for stress. The first one Gary's already mentioned. The first one was shock. Our ignorance of drugs and drug addiction meant that it took us a long time to realize the depth of the problem that our son had. Not only was he addicted to drugs, but he was selling drugs. He was a junkie. We were overwhelmed with shock that a family like ours could have this kind of problem. We just did not see it coming. We assumed that a problem like that, a kid going off the rails that way, only happened in families with parents who were inattentive or distracted. Or perhaps in families that didn't have a solid Christian foundation, the way we were confident that ours did. So how on earth did this happen to us? Next, there came shame. The shock was followed by shame. Both of us were active in parish life here. Both of us taught scripture classes. We were known as enthusiastic and knowledgeable evangelical converts to the church. Our son and one daughter attended a fine Catholic school. We thought of all the silent judgments that we had ever made about parents with troubled children. My first thought had always been when I saw a kid who was troubled, my first thought, I wouldn't ever say it, but I thought it, flawed parenting. Those his parents did something wrong to turn out a kid like that. Mm-hmm. So then we assumed that others would now heap all of those judgments on us. And we heaped them on ourselves as well. We were embarrassed and humiliated. We felt like failures. So we were stripped down, raw by emotion, fear, grinding pain, guilt. What was left of us? The second S word is separation. Not physical, but in some ways just as strong. As most of us know anecdotally, we often marry spouses who are temperamentally different from us. Usually, these differences only cause minor irritations or challenges. Often, they can become a source of family humor. And regularly, these differences can serve to strengthen each spouse in his or her weakness. However, in a family crisis, differences in personality can cause a break between the spouses. In our marriage, Gary is, by nature, optimistic, easygoing, low-key, sanguine. I, on the other hand, by nature, am pessimistic, high-strung, driven, and not a little OCD. So when the catastrophe hit, we acted out of our primal natures. Gary was prone to minimize the problem, to be reluctant to confront it or our son. He was able to compartmentalize it so that he could do his day job and we could still pay our bills. He was not thinking about it all the time. I was hypervigilant, suspicious. I was consumed by the problem. I was always thinking of trying to find a solution. And then in addition to personality differences, there is an abiding difference in how fathers and mothers relate to children in their God-given vocations. I expect that all of us with children are somewhat acquainted with these differences. An example that I often use is that when our kids were little, once we were out in the backyard and they were playing in this modest little treehouse that we had. I had to go inside. So I asked Gary, "Can you watch the kids?" He said, "Yes." So while I was inside, I heard crying. I went outside. A kid had fallen out of the treehouse. I said to Gary, "I asked you to watch the kids." And Gary said, "I did watch them." And I said, "Well, I meant watch them so they don't fall out of the tree and not watch them while they're out of the tree." These differences in roles and natures designed by God are meant to provide the child with the fullness of parental love and guidance built on the unique gifts from both father and mother. However, this complex layering of personality and vocational differences often left us feeling like two people living with the same problem on opposite sides of the planet. What can result in this kind of separation in a marriage? The next word, scapegoating. How predictable. Two people with very different ideas of how to live with a huge, terrifying problem would begin to find fault with each other. For us, it was accusing each other of either exaggerating or underestimating what had overtaken us. And this set the stage for nearly constant friction because we didn't have a joint vision of the extent of the problem or the path to its solution. And this led to the last S, the most tragic and damaging effect of a family crisis on marriage, and that is the sabotage of sacramental unity. A couple in a family crisis is very susceptible to putting the problem at the center of family life rather than keeping their sacrament as the priority. This is damaging not only to themselves but to other children who may be in the family. So rather than working hard to preserve that bond of unity, which is the grace of our sacrament felt so strongly on our wedding day, we worked hard on advancing our own opinions to the solution, to the problem and its solution. At the very time when we most needed our sacrament's power to keep us from fracturing into a thousand troubled pieces, we withdrew from each other, isolated, frustrated, resentful. And meanwhile, the problem continued. The sabotage of marriage is the devil's favorite work in families. So perhaps it's worth taking a moment to recall what happened in the Garden of Eden, where the devil, represented poetically by the serpent, makes his first appearance in the human story. Remember that the serpent made his pitch to Eve by questioning God's trustworthiness. The temptation basically boiled down to this: God's not really on your side. He doesn't have your best interests at heart. You need to figure things out for yourself. And that has remained his constant whisper to us throughout the ages. In a family crisis, he tempts us to question why God would let something like this happen. Why doesn't God answer our prayers? And for me, why, when I'm praying, things are getting worse? They're not getting better, they're getting worse. Why do we feel so abandoned in this time of need? From there, it's a very short step to thinking that we need to take charge, we need to figure things out, or to feel disappointed or disillusioned with God. Let's go back to the garden for a minute. Eve was supposed to be Adam's helper. She listened to the serpent's lies, and she made a unilateral decision to grasp the fruit. The only reference that she made to her husband was to turn to him and give him some of the fruit to eat as well. Adam, by the way, was standing right there with her. The Hebrew text makes this very clear. So why was he completely silent during all of this? God had put him in charge of the garden. Why was he willing to let the serpent malign God's character? Why not step in and send the enemy away? Was he afraid? Or was he quietly weighing his options, evaluating the appeal of the serpent's proposition to be like God without God? Personally, I suspect that that's what was happening. Man, in his God-designed nature, is initiator. He's full of physical strength to act, to defend, to protect, to be independent. Woman, in her nature, is receiver, nurturer, dependent while she's caring for the young, practical. We know these truths from our own bodies, and they were true before the fall. Did man's nature make him vulnerable to wanting complete independence, the kind the devil was offering? Did woman's nature make her vulnerable to seeing only the practical appeal of eating the forbidden fruit and not its larger implication? We don't know, but we have to wonder something, or at least I have wondered for years over this. What difference would it have made if Eve, the wife that God had given Adam to help him, had done the one needful, helpful thing at that moment? What if Eve had simply turned to Adam and said, "What do you think God wants us to do? What do you think God wants us to do?" Would her glance in God's direction have helped Adam remember that we can only be like God with God? Is that why God said it's not good to be alone? Did they need each other in order to stay true to their design? The enemy always seeks to drive a wedge, first between God and his children, and then between husband and wife. And a family crisis gives him fertile ground in which to sow his evil seeds. So what happened that eventually enabled us to be here as a married couple tonight and not the formally married but now divorced Summers? When we finally realized that we were in over our heads we got outside help. Ironically, Christians can be susceptible to arriving late at this step. That was certainly true of us. We thought because of our prayer and our Christian faith and our love, the support of the church, the sacraments, we could fix our son. Why would we need outside help? Maybe more mass attendance, maybe more time in adoration, but why would we need outside help when we had all these resources of our faith? We were so entrenched in this way of thinking that it took our son's first near-fatal overdose, a few years into his addiction, for us to wake up. We had our priest friend, Father John Eric, many of you know him, come in, do the last rites for Gary. He was in ICU. We did not know if he was going to recover. He did recover. And when he recovered, he left the hospital and went right back to drugs. Finally, the light came on. Finally, we realized that in addition to our faith and the help of the church, we needed something else. For us, that took the form of Al-Anon, an organization giving education and help to people whose loved ones suffer from substance abuse. We discovered that we had a lot to learn about addiction, and really even more to learn about ourselves. We learned to work the 12 steps to break our addiction to the worry and the fear and the control that had so long been a part of our lives. We were liberated from the shame over our son's problem. That kind of shame, that shame over a kid who's gone off the rails, is really a deceptive form of parental pride and ego. We are too worried about the child's problem reflecting badly on us. We had to get over that, and with the help of Al-Anon, we did. When we learned to get over ourselves, we could see that scapegoating was a waste of time and energy. We each worked with a sponsor, so we had someone else to talk to about the problem instead of each other. This liberated us to return to normal family conversations in which our son and his problem were not the centerpiece. When the air began to clear, and this took time, we remembered our sacrament. We remembered its gift of supernatural unity if only we seek it and receive it. As Gary said, the unity of the sacrament is not magically and automatically there when the crisis hits. In fact, it can seem to entirely disappear. And that's a great danger to the couple and family life. It was Al-Anon, ironically, that helped to restore our confidence in God's love and wisdom, no matter what we saw in our son. Now, I say ironically because Christians know this. We know this theologically and confessionally. We know that God is loving, wise, kind. But living in a family crisis the way we did forced us to actually live it. We knew that our son's addiction meant that he could die at any moment. What would that do to our faith? Long before he actually did die, we practiced the foundational truth that lies at the heart of Catholic sacramental life. At the heart of every sacrament is this one simple truth. There is more here than meets the eye. There is more here than meets the eye. That is the lesson of the cross. And we often saw such frightening darkness in our situation that we had to really live like we believed this. There is more here than meets the eye. I had to use a prayer that I put together in the really dark and difficult times. And it was this: Father, I thank you that you are working out your good, perfect, and loving plan in Gary's life even now. Sometimes I had to pray that every hour of the day, maybe a couple of times in an hour. Father, thank you that I know you are working out your good, perfect, and loving plan in Gary's life even now. In time, our orientation shifted away from the problem and the fear associated with it to God's power, His love, His goodness. And as a result, we wanted to nurture and strengthen our sacrament. This took work, and it took time. We had a lot of bad habits that we had to break. But we understood, finally, how desperately we needed it to sustain us in the whirlwind. One example of a change that we made as a result of getting healthy was that we resolved that only if both of us, not just one of us, but both of us saw troubling signs in our son, we would address it with him right away. This helped to keep us grounded in facing the problem together. It was a corrective for my tendency to act unilaterally, and for Gary's tendency not to act at all. Over time, we found great strength and wisdom in our graced unity. So now, flash forward to our son's unexpected and profoundly heartbreaking sudden death last year. Every parent's worst nightmare coming true. We discovered that although that event certainly qualifies as a family crisis, we were able to endure it and face it together. We did not experience any of the stages that we had faced at the onset of the problem 14 years earlier. There was shock, but no shame. There was no separation between us. Even with our very different personalities, we grieved differently because a mother's relationship with a son is different from a father's relationship, but we grieved together. And that unity was truly a gift in such a devastating and emotional time. There was no scapegoating. There was no sabotage of our sacramental unity. In fact, we discovered quite the opposite. Within just a few hours of getting the news, we both of us had a profoundly deep understanding and acceptance of what had happened. Both of us believed that although Satan won the battle that night when the darkness overcame our son, God won the war, taking him to himself, delivering him from the terrible pain and shame of his bondage to drugs that we knew he had, healing him, liberating him once and for all in a way that our love and the love of all his friends could never do. And we both found peace knowing that we will see him again. And when we do, he will be the dear, beautiful son that God always had in mind for us. Now I have a question. Is this just wishful thinking? Is this brainwashing so that we could live with what happened? Our son went badly off the rails. Why can we be so confident that he's in eternity now with Jesus and that we'll see him again? Friends, that is another talk, not tonight. We would be glad to give that, but that is not our topic tonight. Ours was a specific kind of family crisis. But we think that we can make a few suggestions from our experience that would apply to any family crisis. First, get outside help from people knowledgeable about the crisis that you are facing. If you are in over your heads, and how do you know that you're in over your heads? Well, you'll see stress, have arguments, you'll feel despair, desperation, isolation, fear, and confusion in your faith life. If those things are happening, seek outside help. This can come from counselors, from others with experience in the same problem, reading helpful and informative books, priestly direction, lots of different places. It requires humility to accept our own limitations and to reject any idea that seeking help is a sign of weakness or a lack of faith. Unwillingness to admit that we have a serious problem is simply a form of pride. It doesn't mean talking to everyone we know about the problem, but it does mean being radically honest with ourselves and each other that we need help. Next, remember your sacrament. No matter how far apart you may seem in approaching the problem, you need to work hard at remembering and believing that God has given you grace of supernatural unity available right in the middle of it. So do whatever it takes to keep this truth uppermost in your mind, especially when the disunity reaches a crescendo. Keep a wedding photo on your kitchen counter. Put a copy of your wedding vows on the fridge. Write scripture verses and put them on the mirrors, like the two shall become one flesh. Whatever it takes to keep you focused on that sacramental unity. Set aside time every day to pray together and guard it jealously. This sounds obvious, and this is probably something that we're all doing when we're not in family crisis, but trust me, when we're in family crisis, everything goes out the window. All the spiritual disciplines, you forget that there's even a thing called prayer. So it's not so obvious when the crisis hits. Even if you're barely speaking to each other during the day, and let's be real, family crisis means tension between spouses. You may be at such loggerheads that you're barely speaking, but sit down and pray before you go to bed. This can be short, doesn't have to be long, but it cannot be missed. And finally, remember this, you may not be in a family crisis tonight, but you never know when one may arrive. Don't make the mistake of thinking this only happens to other people. Use even small non-crisis episodes in your marriage that cause some disunity to practice the grace of the sacrament. Watch out for scapegoating, fault finding, even in small episodes. It's good to recall that Satan in the book of Revelation is described as standing before the throne of God, accusing the brethren night and day. That's what he loves to do. He is the master of scapegoating, and we owe him nothing. If we use even small family skirmishes as opportunities to turn first to the supernatural grace of unity and love in our marriages, should the day arrive when the darkness closes in, you'll be much better prepared for it. We hope that tonight we have communicated to you that although family crisis does put a significant stress on any marriage, and some marriages don't survive, they crack, it is also a profound opportunity to deepen and strengthen and enrich the sacrament of marriage. And when that happens, then we become true witnesses to the world of the love of Christ, as Gary said, that love that Jesus has for his church, the bride. Thank you.